As advertised, we're going to be spending most of the program today talking about this proposed rate hike, a 5% hike on Metro North and Shoreline East. And that's a pretty substantial increase when you look at the amount of money commuters are paying, particularly when they commute to New York. And so we'll get into this with our guests today, Senator Tony Huang and also Jim Cameron, who's a transportation advocate and has a great blog, talkingtransportation.blogspot.com. But that said, we welcome to the program the senator from the 28th District, which is down along the shore, that area of Connecticut, Trumbull, Senator Tony Huang. Senator, welcome to Front and Center.
Thanks, Dan. Thank you so much for having me.
Tony, what are we to make of these proposed rate hikes?
Well, I think the explanation that was given was the fact that the budgetary malaise and the unexpected lack of savings from the budget required the cuts from the transportation allocation, which impacted the transportation and the trains. But again, I have to go all the way back to the beginning, in which the budget process that was approved in June of last year was always flawed from the get-go, and that the analysis and the thought that went into passing a budget that simply did not work is wreaking havoc and putting an unfair burden on constituents in this community state. I mean, when you say all that, because the reality is, you know, not only are transportation budgets being slashed unexpectedly in the middle, education and everything else that relates to how we operate the state. So we have to go back and talk about how the state budget was designed and vetted. And we simply didn't do a good enough job. And what's unfortunate is our businesses, our commuters, our education, and our critical social services are all suffering the consequences of a very, very poorly vetted budget.
Now, you're talking about the budget when it was passed in June 2015, the two-year budget. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And we have been trying to fix a bad budget since day one. And that has been the challenge, is we're forced to make cuts and impose additional burden on commuters because of a budget process that was broken, that was not transparent, and in my humble opinion, when it was passed, absolutely unsustainable. We've gone back in the last three or four particular sessions since that budget has been approved to try to fix the unexpected results of a very badly vetted budget. And people need to remember that 5% was put into an additional 1% increase that's slotted to go into schedule that we put into the budget to pay for additional trains. We absolutely need additional trains. And the fact is, we need to make a commitment of allocation to transportation funding. I would evaluate and consider bonding and allocation of priority funding to fix our rails and our roads in the community. And one of the things that we argued against was the fact that, are we really putting good money when we invest in the fast track, that bus line from New Britain to Hartford, of additional tax money that could have been much better spent fixing our rails, fixing our roads and major corridors in southwestern Connecticut? But again, a bad budget process where party politics played in, and when you didn't have Republicans, who represents close to 45% of the constituency in the state, never had a chance to have that debate in presenting a budget that was predictable, sustainable, and transparent. And unfortunately, everything we're going to talk about as it relates to the rails, as it relates to any other cost of cuts to education in our communities, and that's going to impact our businesses, the problem is it stems from a very bad budget from the beginning. And I hope we learn our lesson and don't impose these kind of unexpected surprises and unfortunate burdens on the people in our state.
So what you're saying is when this budget was put together, and it's usually passed at the last minute in the dead of night at the state legislature in June of 2015, the Republicans did not have a seat at that table.
Without a doubt. One party rule, it doesn't work in Hartford. It doesn't even work in my household. The fact that we need to bring different ideas, different viewpoints, and create a package that is the best for everyone in our state. And I learned that lesson as a legislator when one of the first things I was very proud that we did as a bipartisan basis, House and Senate, was in 2009, 2010, in a special session, we passed a jobs bill that looked at apprenticeship credits, that looked at tax credits for new hiring. We looked at brownfield remediation. We looked at small business express programs. That was a bill in which both parties sat in the room and ironed out what differences and what the positives and the negatives were. To this day, Dan, we still point to that bill as a landmark success that we are trying to implement to help businesses in our state. Let's work together.
By the way,
one party rule doesn't work anymore.
Well, I was just going to say, and I want to go on the record because they might be listening at home. One party rule doesn't work in my house either. I want to make that clear.
We should learn from the households that we represent. And you know, I'm fighting the fight on the healthcare insurance increases. We have grown so detached from what our small businesses, what our households that we represent endure and tolerate. And they feel that the game is rigged against them. They feel that they have no control in the system and that special interest and politics always wins out, and that the Joes and the Jills and the little guys and gals are never, ever going to win this game. And we need to understand as legislative leaders that we represent the people. And we should conduct and think about how we create legislations and create initiatives to reflect the needs and the practices and the attitudes and of the people that we represent, like households. You know, one party doesn't rule in your house nor in mine. And perhaps it's shown it doesn't work in Hartford either.
Now, and you know him, transportation advocate Jim Cameron, who, by the way, says he supports your reelection, but he came out and wrote on his transportation blog that Governor Malloy should not be blamed for the latest fare hikes, that the blame falls squarely on the shoulders of the state legislature. What do you say to that?
Well, I think I somewhat agree with him, because it goes back to how we budget, right? I think it goes back to how we govern. We passed out a budget, Dan, that was not vetted. We passed out a budget that raided transportation funds year after year, even in the middle of us passing a constitutional amendment effort to keep money from the lockbox. We draft language that says we can raid money before it goes in a lockbox. So I agree with Jim. Jim has been a tremendous commuter advocate, and he speaks without any hesitation of the interest of commuters. I mean, we worked together to restore the commuter rail council that was going to be the advocate that the governor eliminated. But it does go back. We as legislative leaders need to take ownership. But I'm going back to the budget that was passed without Republican input in a one-party rule that started leaking the day it was passed. It was a budget that had an impact in affecting GE's decision, and it's impacting businesses like Aetna and Cigna to consider staying in our state. And for us to lose Rogers Corporation, a company that is 180-plus years, a company that has been respected for making, you know, shoes to aerospace products, for them to decide that Connecticut is no longer going to be their home is another kick in the stomach that the state can no longer endure. And what we're doing right now is hurting mid-sized and small businesses and independent contractors who are bearing the burden. I mean, I can't even talk about the health care insurance increases. It's absolutely outrageous.
Well, along the lines of, and maybe we'll have time to get into health insurance as well. I've talked about that the last few days on this show. But getting back to transportation, this impacts anybody who rides public transportation, not only the commuter trains, but also those who ride the buses, including the aforementioned CT Fast Track, would have to pay an increase of 25 cents per ride, Tony.
Well, you know, people say it's 25 cents, it's 40 cents, and then we have the discussion of tolls and mileage taxes. And what it comes back to, again, is in talking to the people in our communities, it is a death by a thousand cuts and or a thousand taxes or a thousand revenue sources. We got to get back and sit at the table and say, what can we do in controlling our spending and creating efficiencies in our government and looking at what we want versus what we truly need. Again, it goes back to the budget process where both parties, multiple interest groups can sit at the table and say, let's work on something that is in the greater interest and representative of the households and the people that we represent throughout the state. You can add up anything and add up that it is creating a burden, and the numbers are not lying, Dan. Businesses are suffering. You can't be ranked 50th out of 51 states in the worst place to do business. And this is a nonpartisan George Mason University, Maricatas Center. They looked at our liabilities and our state's fiscal condition, and we're 50th out of 51, only outdone by Puerto Rico. And the story on Puerto Rico isn't very pretty.
Talking with State Senator Tony Hoang. Tony, as I understand it, even though DOT is going to hold public hearings starting on September 1st on these proposed rate hikes, they can unilaterally impose these fare hikes that the state legislature really doesn't have a say in the process. Is that correct?
Unfortunately, that is correct. But at the same time, I think we proposed reviewing Metro North contract this past year, because there was a clause in there that allowed us to review it. And institutionally, we felt that that was a risk that we couldn't take. I would have gladly reevaluated our contractor relationship. I would have gladly reevaluated what our state's role in taking a much more active engagement on how these rail line contracts and how our transportation works into the future. Look, we've been guilty as a legislative body in the past of saying, well, you know, transportation is business as usual, perhaps. But I am sharing with you it has created a economic impact in our community and an adverse quality of life impact in our community. And we need to reevaluate and take a much more active as well as a proactive role and how these kind of agreements and the limitations that we have in control of how we implement these policies are moving forward. We need to do a better job, and we needed to do it yesterday. But again, saying that, I'm ready to do it today.
Now, you mentioned, obviously, that the fares went up last year as well, but actually the fares have gone up every year since 2012, Tony.
Well, it's just as we talked about it with the insurance, the health insurance is, what other choice does a commuter have? Again, the commuters feel that it is a rigged game from the fare increases. What other alternatives do they have? And the combined with that, and I think that's what the kicker for everyone is, that service has not improved. Time has been longer. Delays are more frequent. And overcrowding has been the norm versus the exception. So we're paying more for less service, and we have no voice in it. And I think that's where the frustration builds. You know, I get through the commuter council advocate organization that Jim puts together and talking to a lot of commuter advocates. The bottom line is this, what choice do we have? We have to do a far better job in being responsive. And maybe we can explore a public-private relationship where motivating interest in the private sector can give a little jolt of service as well as innovative, creative thinking. You know, when you leave this country or when you leave this area and you go down to Washington, D.C., and you look at the various other rail lines and transportation structures from different countries and different states, you realize that we are so far behind, and we need to be visionary, proactive, as well as understanding we have to make a significant infrastructure commitment. And I do applaud the governor in his focus and his vision, but the problem was he never gave any concrete financing. He never really made some commitment to how we would institutionally and organizationally make that commitment to funding down the road. A 30-year deal just doesn't seem reasonable. And we need to understand that people operate and businesses need to operate now. And we're not doing it.
Now, you're proposing that these transportation projects be bonded. Is that correct?
Yes, I think we have bonded a lot of things that we probably should not have. Case in point, a statute, however well-intentioned, is not something that we want to look at bonding at this present time in our fiscal situation. I'm sure it's well-meaning, but to give $1 million-plus dollars in bonding to paint a mural in an indoor building at in Winsted is not where I think we should allocate our bonding priorities. We should bond and make a 10, 20, 30 year investment to innovating and creating a world-class transportation infrastructure, because it'll help our businesses, it'll improve the quality of life in our communities. And I'm not simply saying southwestern Connecticut, I'm saying throughout our whole state. And we've not done that. And again, it has to go back, Dan, to what we said in the beginning. We have to, as a legislative body, make the budgetary decisions that places these as priorities and not simply maintain government and the structural spendings that we've had. We have to transform government, create efficiencies. I simply believe it is not that we don't tax enough. It is that we have a spending problem and we need to control it.
So if we were to bond a obviously huge amount of money in order to underwrite the cost of these massive transportation improvements that are needed from an infrastructure standpoint, wouldn't we max out a state credit card, which is already precipitously close to being maxed out?
Without a doubt. But then that goes back to what I said. Should we not explore the priorities of our bonding? Again, making infrastructure commitments that will last 10, 20, 30 years is what the noble efforts of bonding is. The idea that we may bond for operating expenditures and for niceties that we all love to have within our communities, perhaps not. And again, the other factor of bonding is, why don't we create greater efficiencies in our government? Looking at work rules. And I just want to applaud that we have actually started to make dents on overtime payments. We have a long way to go. We have to create efficiencies in our governmental infrastructure. We have to look at our dual delivery infrastructure of critical social services and developmental disability services. We need to look at a single provider system that is efficient, that delivers a service at a cost savings to our state government, and ergo that translated to less taxes on our residents. And from that, we can make the proper investments. But yes, I do believe we need to bond. I do believe we need to make the investments into our infrastructure, but not when you're competing against special political interests that says, I need to get you a mural in Winsted. I got to get you a statue in Hartford. And in my community, we looked at bonding as a critical project to economic as well as public safety. Those are measure and barometers that I looked at. You know, we took funding in our community that looked at creating a microgrid for energy that will protect against public safety in cases of disaster and crisis like we had in Sandy. We looked at asking for bonding to create infrastructure of sewer lines that would help economic growth in communities. We looked at additional bonding requests to help our community public-private businesses so that we can create more economic portals to help our community. Those are things that I think bonding has merit and value. But the niceties of being able to create a statue and to paint a mural, they are important facets of each community's needs, but we have to prioritize and we have to understand these are important needs, but we have to evaluate in the greater goal what the goals of the state is.
Now, I'm looking at these.
It's a difficult decision, but you know what? That's what we were elected to do.
I'm looking at these fare hikes, Senator, and you know this. And by the way, even with these fare hikes, they would close down some ticket windows in Greenwich, South Norwalk, and Bridgeport. But if you commute from Milford to Manhattan, which is not an unusual circumstance, you're going to see your fare go up $21 a month. That's a sizable amount.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the travel time has been extended. And the delays are more frequent. It is a double whammy where you're getting less for paying more. And again, we go back to what I express as a frustration for so many people. What other choice do you have?
Right.
Commuters don't. And they are asking for us as legislative leaders to demand greater accountability, greater responsiveness, greater need for action.
Should the legislature...
And, you know, we have to literally pull teeth to get a public hearing on these stuff.
Well, I was going to be my next question. We have a minute left. Should the legislature meet in special session before the election, by the way, to address this particular issue?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We are still at work representing the people. And I've asked for that special session for insurance, health insurance product that has been absolutely outrageous. I mean, ConnectiCare is asking for a 42.7% increase of their existing premium. It the public should know about that. The public should have a say about that. It's been remarkable. We should not stop working for the people we represent, even if it's summertime.
Senator, well said. As always, thanks for spending some time with us today, and I am sure we will talk down the road.
Dan, thank you so much, and I appreciate the opportunity to be on your show. And hello to Jim Cameron as well.
Okay, take care.